Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who has been standing on drawing pins, but it has, through acupuncture, cured his headaches. Come on, should have said that last week. It's Richard Herring! Oh my God, hello! Welcome to the show. Hope you're all right. It's Richard's Leicester Square. I've just admitted to the audience that I had not planned ahead with anything that I was about to come out of my mouth, including who the particular cool kids this week are. But I was hanging around with CJ Demouy when he was. He was in a pantomime. It was fine, it wasn't, there was no canals. He calls it Rahulastapa, so that might catch on. Let's have a little. I said I would talk to this gentleman last week. You came last week, didn't you? And I said I've been backstage planning all the barbs I've got for you. What's your name, sir?
Peter.
Peter. That's nice. Peter's name's Peter as well. That's all I've got. It's brilliant. That's the comedic mind. What do you do for a living?
I work in a bank.
You work in a bank. Yeah, which bank, which brand, which bank is it?
I'm not going to say.
You're not going to say? When you get into trouble,
no.
Is it the one that brought down the economy? You've done other things. It's the bank, the evil bank of the most evil people in the world. Good. So it's good that you're, because you're not, if people ask for your password and stuff, you're not meant to say it, are you? So that is good. You've passed the first test of working in a bank, not telling us which. Because if you told us, we'd know. There's no one guarding the bank. We could all go and rob the bank, couldn't we? What's the most rewarding thing about working in an anonymous bank?
They helped me learn Chinese once.
They helped you learn Chinese? That's a fucking big clue. That is a big clue. That's not the Midland, is it? That's not it. You don't work for the Midland. You don't work for Midland, do you?
Don't work for Bradford and Bingley, do you? Do you remember talking to Bradford and Bingley? They call it a holestopus. So it's nice to meet you. That's all I can. There was nothing. You're a nice looking guy. There's nothing to. Remember I was talking about eggheads a minute ago? So it's what? Oh, he just went there, didn't he? And he ruined it. It looked like he was not going to do it. And some guys here, like the guy with his arms folded, which is always the kind of person I like to pick on, because it's like they're saying, you know, there's no way you're going to talk to me with my folded arms. What's your name?
Will,
that's good. It's a nice name. And what do you do for a living, Will? You don't work in a bank, do you? Do you? Let me guess. Do you work in IT, Will? No! What? Have you ever considered a career in IT? What? So what do you do for a living?
I work for a council.
You work for a council? In the IT department? No. Which council is it? Are you not allowed to say? And you probably shouldn't say. Fine. It's a secretive front row. It's all these guys together. They're a cabal of the bank, the council. Do you do good at the council, or are you one of the people who does evil at the council? Education, that's hard to take. No, that's good, Will. I can't take the piss. You've got the moral high ground. Well done. I thought of a really nasty thing to say. You know what it was, don't you? Yeah, so it's good. We'll move on. Thanks, Will. Thank you. Love to meet you both, Peter and Will. They're nice guys. I'm not the kind of guy who's going to be mean. That's not what I'm like. So will you please welcome my guest this week? He is only known... as the man from the pot noodle advert. Though, before that, he did... he was one of the writers on the Radio 4 pilot, That's Wiggins Yacht. It's Peter Bateman, ladies and gentlemen! Peter Bateman! Come in, sit down, Bob. Oh... Peter Bainham.
I have done many important adverts.
So, let's just talk about the pot noodle advert and nothing else.
Yeah, yeah.
You were in the pot noodle advert.
I was.
Do you know, now you live in LA now.
Yes.
Do people shout too gorgeous to you in the street quite a lot? Is that still happening?
My child does, actually. Right. I showed it to my daughter a couple of weeks ago, and she just is obsessed with it now. So it's punishment all over again. 20 years later. Hey, Dada, too gorgeous. Say it. I used to get ganged up on by Welsh men in Cardiff at the time. That was my punishment for, as pointed at the time, for sucking the cock of Satan, as I think you and Stuart used to tell me. Do you remember, by the way, where, I think it was after we... shared a flat, that I got my own flat with my pot noodle billions. And I came home one night and there were like 18 messages on my answer phone. And the first, I think, was Stuart Lee saying, hello, my name's Stuart Lee. I hear you suck cocks behind bus stations. And I need my penis sucked. And then it was a series of other people, none of whom I'd ever heard of, and saying, like, excuse me, I have a cock, it needs to be sucked, preferably behind a bus station. And I was crying by the end of it. You know...
I don't remember. I've remembered you, but I've forgotten about this.
Yes.
And I did... You and me used to.
I did do that behind the bus station, by the way. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's money, and it's all money.
Oh yeah.
We used to leave a lot of messages for each other on each other's answers.
Horrible ones, yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's.
I hope those tapes don't exist on an old British Telecom answer phone.
I alluded to it in one of the shows, but basically, if there was a terrible crime in the news. I'm trying to think what the least offensive one would be.
Let's not pick an example right now. This is being recorded. You know it's been recorded.
It's being recorded. But we go, sorry about killing all those people.
Wasn't it? But if you'd like to join me on my next killing spree, just meet me behind the bus station.
What a wonderful wasted time we had.
Terrible, yes. Used to... Give me quite a hard time about stealing your bread as well.
Oh, yeah.
For quite a long time. Yeah. But
give me some bread back. You stole loads of bread.
Pete, do you mind if I do an impersonation of you? Or,
yeah, go ahead.
You just say, oh, this is going to be really awful, but hey, Pete, you know the bread, Pete? The bread that I left in the fridge, Pete? It was still out this morning, Pete. Do you ever put people's bread away, Pete, or do you think it's okay just to take it?
I stand by that.
Yes.
That's an impression that makes the person, it makes you look foolish. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't remember ever keeping the bread in the fridge.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I used to steal your food.
Yeah. Well, it's fun. Now, what was mine was yours. It was fun. We did share a flat. Yep. We met in the early 90s in the weekending offices in Sixteen Langham Place, which is no longer there. Have you been back to the BBC recently?
I go there now and again, yeah.
It's been destroyed, there. Sixteen Langham Place.
Yes. Because of us.
Because of us. Yeah. Like the house where some terrible killings have happened. They just say, we have to knock this down because of the awful people who were once here.
We'd already become a tourist attraction.
Yeah.
The place where we used to go and make radio shows and then kill people.
Well, if you think about the terrible things that have been done at the BBC and they haven't knocked the places down.
Yes.
We must have done something pretty bad.
Turned them into luxury flats, haven't they? Television centre.
Everywhere that I worked has been destroyed, either by diggers or fire or gentrification.
It's a pattern, yeah.
So the riverside in Hammersmith, we used to do loads of stuff there. That's been knocked down. They're rebuilding it, turning into flats. Where else? Oh, ITV Studios, where I did Time, Gentlemen, Please. That's about to be redeveloped. BBC's been redeveloped. They've knocked down 16 Langham Place. It's like someone is just out there trying to destroy all trace of anywhere I ever worked.
You wanted a blue plaque instead of which they just bulldoze it.
Yeah, there's nowhere to put the blue plaque. So we met on Weekending.
Mm-hmm.
Did you enjoy writing for the Weekending?
I don't think I ever wrote anything funny for it, but that wasn't sort of the point, was it? It was about hitting a deadline and writing something involving John Major on a tightrope.
Yeah.
And, you know, a political tightrope. And, you know, it was amazing. There used to be these... Do you remember the strange men that were on that show? Well, us, obviously, but, you know. But there were people... There was one guy that used to show me... He had a sketch. For anyone who doesn't remember, which is because it was like 20 years ago, wasn't it? It was a topical weekly sketch show.
On Radio 4.
On Radio 4.
And you could go in, anyone could go in.
Any crazy person.
Into the office and write for it.
Yes. And men would turn up with cans of beer in bags and just write terrible sketches and they'd get on. That was me, obviously. And but people would turn up. And this one man would have a sketch about the NHS, a political sketch, and he would just get it out once every 3 months because they would change producers and then he would just give the sketch in again. And he would laugh wickedly to me and go, they don't know that I got this sketch on and I got paid £10 for it 3 months ago. I think, it's not that impressive.
I was talking about this, I was being interviewed by James O'Brien this afternoon, so we talked about Weekending and all that early time, and it was sort of insane. We were paid like, per minute,
yes,
and it was £22 a minute, I think,
yes,
you got paid, and like, so a week where you didn't get anything on was like that, you didn't have like a potato that week,
yes,
you know, one, you know, not you, but it was sort of a weird time. You had cut an unusual route into comedy, Peter, in that you're the only comedian I know who has a license to drive a super tanker. You're in the Merchant Navy.
Yeah. The notorious stranglehold that the Merchant Navy has on British comedy. The elite. Strange racist sailors of the Merchant Navy.
How long were you in the Merchant Navy for?
5 years.
So out of school? Or was it straight out of school?
Yeah, 16.
Yeah.
It was a completely ridiculous idea. I wanted to see the world. And nobody, for a second, took me aside and said, have you heard of interrailing? You know, maybe just, you know, get a backpack and go around Europe for a bit, instead of which I joined a chemical tanker company. And I remember, like, just before I went off on my first trip, I said to my dad, Dad, I'm not sure about this. And he said, no, you should go. And I think maybe just hated me or something. And so I kind of went off and cried. It wasn't like I was built for it, or look at me, like, you know, it was ridiculous. And I'm 5 years in, and my wife now just still on a daily basis can't believe that I was qualified to navigate supertankers. She thinks it's fucking...
How hard is it? Because we had Mackenzie Cook on the other week who can drive a tube train.
Right.
But it took him 10 minutes to learn how to do that. Okay. Is it the same with a supertanker?
Yeah, well, I can't navigate a Toyota, you know, with the GPS in it. And, okay. It's really hard, and you have to learn to navigate by the stars. Right. And you operate, you know, radar and all these kind of things. And yeah. I was awful at it. And I also, the trouble is that the two most important words in the Merchant Navy were, well, there were other ones, but common sense. And it was the currency of all those worlds where it's about knowing what you're doing and having practical solutions to those things. And I would be sent off to go and get a spanner, and they would just find me more or less crying in the engine room because I'd panicked and couldn't find a spanner, and then they'd come and find me, and then I'd get told off. And I nearly hit a ferry on the first time I was on it. I would have been responsible for an international incident if I hadn't quite properly been fired 5 years in.
So you're fired?
Well, made redundant. I'm glamorising it. I was made redundant.
Did they say, you'll never drive a supertanker again?
You are an idiot. Well, I think they probably realised I was a twat and was just terrible at it.
But did you see the world? Or did you
I did, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Did you get to get out of the supertanker when you got somewhere?
Yeah. Occasionally, yeah. And on my first trip away, the exciting thing was that the rudder fell off my ship. I didn't do it. It fell off the ship in the South China Sea, and I was floating. The ship was floating. I wasn't personally floating, but the ship was floating for about 2 weeks. And my dad got a telegram. That's how long ago this is. Now old I am. My dad got a telegram addressed to next of kin of Peter Bainham. And said regret. You know, it's probably like stop regret. Your small son. Lost at sea, stop, you know. That was kind of it. And, yeah. And that was my first trip.
Did you say it's my first day? Sorry,
yeah, my first day, yeah. Not going so well.
So I nearly hit that ferry and the rudder.
Terrible. And I got poisoned with benzene. I once... I was once standing for no decent reason in 2 feet of water with an electric drill, and you know, there's a button you can press on a drill. You can take your finger off the trigger so the drill bit keeps turning. And I had that obviously when you're standing in water, what you don't want to be able to do is to turn off the drill. And so I put it in the hole that I was drilling, and that got stuck in the thing, started spinning around, and then fell into the water. And I think that was still my first trip, you know. So why I'm alive, who knows?
But you did 5 years. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
I wanted to leave after 2 years, and it was the height of Thatcherism, and there were no jobs. And my dad said, "Well, even though he got a letter addressed to next of kin." I think after my first trip, I came home and said, "Dad, I'm not sure this is for me." He said, "No, you made a choice. You stick to it." And so I went back, and you know, and then 5 years in, I was so shit at all of it, really bad, you know. And somehow I qualified, and once I qualified, you know, and that's when I nearly hit the ferry, and that's when we parted company.
Right. And so what then drove you into the waters of weekend?
Yes, well, that was the only other choice. That was the only other way to go to see the world, was to go to...
Well, it's worked. Yeah. It was a long way round, but it did.
Yeah. Interrailing round the... No, I'll try and do the short, semi-interesting version. It was like, I went to London with my redundancy check and had some vague idea of wanting to be in some form of entertainment. And
right.
I think you might have, but a lot of comedy people I've met had the same book, which is From Fringe to Flying Circus.
Yeah, yeah.
The book, it seems to be every comedy person had this brilliant book about the comedy family tree from Beyond the Fringe through to Monty Python's Flying Circus. And I had a vague idea from that of like, oh, well, there's this world. But even though I knew there was stand-up and I knew there's comedy, in Wales, where we didn't have electricity and, you know, there was no awareness of like, going into that world. So I came up with a very vague idea. I did amateur theatre for a bit, and that was just terrible. I tried to get into RADA, and it was just, you know, ridiculous.
So you were still 21 when you came
into 21,
to
London. 22, yeah. But I had no idea whatsoever. And then my brother saw an advert for Kit Hollaback's You know Keller Hardback? Improv comedy workshop at the Comedy Store. On a Saturday morning, I went there. It was Mike Myers.
Right.
Mike Myers, and there was Paul Merton, and there was all these brilliant people, and that was just like, oh, okay. And then I found out about stand-up from that.
Right.
And then when stand-up was a disaster, another 5 years in, because I was terrible at stand-up, I found out about Weekending.
Were you doing characters? Because you did characters when I saw you doing...
Yes.
So you did on the stand-up circuit I don't know all this about you.
Oh, you do?
No, I don't really know what you were doing before I met you. I wasn't interested. I never asked you about them. Just so you could drive a super tanker.
This moment on a stage where you...
Just go west. It's because there was so much... The bread was out. And by the time...
Yeah.
By the time we got through that, I'm going, he's got to go. He's gone out now.
Yeah.
I was going to ask him about...
Yeah. Pete?
So were you doing Mr. Buxted?
I was doing Mr. Buxted, the Welsh maths teacher.
Yeah.
40% of the time would go okay, and 60% of the time would die horribly. And I heard it a couple of months ago just online, and I was appalled. It was so horrible. It was a really unpleasant man who would just kill people with hammers. It was very, and it was like, I stopped it. I'm terrified of stand-up, and I tried to hide behind characters, and the one character I hid behind was a murderous maths teacher.
But I didn't like stand-up, and I did. I sort of tried to do characters and tried to do myself, and did myself with a Somerset accent because I was sort of hiding behind that. And it's it was really difficult. But then when we sort of started going to Edinburgh and doing shows in Edinburgh, you were doing... I remember you did a Tory politician.
Oh yeah,
do you remember that character? Oh. And you'd go, if it's a crime to kill 5 people with a hammer, I don't know what it was, then lock me up. That sort of thing, wasn't it? Do you remember that guy?
I don't.
No,
I don't remember a whole character.
I think you was in club. You probably were a little bit involved with Club Z and things like that.
Yeah,
and then,
but you
also in Edinburgh, you did this late night thing with where you were monsters.
Yes, Monsters in the Attic, which became this strange thing that I did.
Well, it was a sort of cult Edinburgh sort of smash that you just decided to do on the spur of the moment. Was that
right? Yeah, and in that strange kind of viral thing of not... Well, there's all kinds of viral things at the Edinburgh Festival, but actually metaphorically viral. But I'd done this thing to entertain my flatmates, Woody Bop Muddy, the record graveyard comedian, and I used to entertain them at night by just transforming into these disgusting, horrible monsters, which is and for some reason that got turned into a whole show, but it was a one-off.
Yeah,
and
up in that really hot attic up in the Pleasance. Yeah,
I remember doing it and then actually physically vomiting straight afterwards because I'd had a giant bag of curry and chips just before it.
Oh, happy! What happy days they were, Pete. What wonderful days they were. I would love... This is something I want to ask you.
Yeah.
Now, it's not... Have you... are you aware of the porn actor, Jean Valjean? I mean, you probably wouldn't know his name. I've had to look up his name.
Right.
I think he looks like a sort of really buff version of you.
Really?
Yeah. And I'd like people to Google Valjean. The problem is there's a character in Les Miserables called Jean Valjean. I think he's copied that name the way that porn actors sometimes do. But he hasn't done a spin on it. He's just called himself... unless in France, Jean Valjean means... John, I felt women up the arse, John.
Yes.
Which he does a lot.
Right.
I think he looks like a super handsome version of you.
Mm-hmm.
And it really puts me off.
Really?
Yeah. I can't watch anything he does. Because all the time I'm watching him...
Would it be less distracting if it just was me? Well,
I just wondered if you'd ever been mistaken for Jean Valjean. He's friend. He's good. He's a good actor. Yes. I think he's... I looked him up a bit. I think he gave up porn to become an actual actor. Because he's surprisingly good.
Right.
It's ruined quite a lot of evenings.
It's not
me.
Look him up. Will you write that?
I wondered if people have mistaken you for... If you imagine that really handsome version of you.
Do you think I could?
No.
It would be strange if I watched it and found it quite exciting.
Look him up.
That's a very specific fetish.
I just wondered if anyone
only porn actors that look a little bit like a better looking version of
he's
you.
He's very muscular, but he's got... He's sort of got your face and some of your mannerisms.
Right.
And when he's fucking someone in the arse,
yes,
I reckon that's how you would fuck someone in the arse. I mean, I still watch it, and I managed to.
I mean, when you say my manager, does he stop midway and fucking the woman up the house and say, "Have you seen my wallet anywhere?" Or,
he does.
I can't find my phone.
He leaves the bread out a lot.
Right.
he's making a sandwich. A woman comes in. He starts having sex with her. Right. I'm going, "Oh, mate, put the bread. Let's put the bread back in the fridge." Before he can say to her, "I've just left the bread out. My flatmate is very fussy about this." I'm sure it must have. That must have happened. Okay. So when we did share a flat together, then there's a story that's been told many times by many. Mm-hmm. It's like become a legend. It's been told by many different people. Stuart Lee wrote about it in one of his books, but got it wrong because he said that I said the pertinent thing. Mm-hmm. I did it in my show, We're All Going to Die, and I would like to hear your version of the story of me returning from my grandfather's funeral to the flat we shared. Yes. What are your memories of that?
That moment? Well, I remember you going through the build-up to it's the wrong word, I suppose, isn't it? Whatever. And at the
it wasn't the FA Cup.
Yes,
it wasn't it the FA Cup around, days. He's still alive.
Yeah, it wasn't a common trend. But I remember you at that time, when you're talking about the bread, there would be times when you would perhaps taunt me and say, like, "Are you doing any more pot noodle, lads? Pete, are you going to suck any more cogs behind bus stations? Pete, you can steal my bread, Pete." And you came in. And you did look, admittedly, very sad.
Yeah, I've just been at my granddad's funeral. Yeah.
And you said to me, "My granddad's just died, Pete." And do you think that's funny, Pete? And it was the way you said it was so taunting. I don't know. Maybe you weren't actually taunting me, but there's something about it. You were daring me to say that's funny, and then I said, "I don't think it's funny, but I am delighted." And I think I felt I'd like to think that you bullied me into saying that. But you didn't. But you've then since said that you laughed and cried at the same time.
It's a brilliant, I mean, delighted is such the perfect word. It's not. And it's a man, anyone else say I'm happy?
Yes.
I'm glad that happened. I'm delighted. So I genuinely did. Yes. I laughed. I don't think it's quite hard to do to laugh and cry. But I laughed and I cried, and it wasn't tears of laughter, it was tears of sadness. But I was still laughing. A very funny thing to say.
Wasn't the clue that at the time when you asked me, I was dressed as a 19th century fop? Powdered on my face.
But then your dad died.
Yes.
And then we sort of the reverse thing. You then came into the kitchen quite sad for some reason.
Yeah.
But then I did, and I was very upset as well because I knew that. And then you said, "Are you delighted?" So, I think because in the book it comes, Stuart writes as if I did the funny line, and I didn't do the funny line.
And then you said yes, and I punched you.
I think I went, "Oh, God, no."
Because you have human decency. And I am delighted by the death.
Well, but
nice old men.
But, that's the way. It's interesting. It's the way comedy people are together. Is that you will? I know, and the way of getting through anything. And that's we had a very kind of dark sense of humor together.
Well, I don't even think it's not even like the thing I get annoyed at when people say you can't joke about these things is as if when those things are happening, when bad things are happening, as if funny stuff stops happening. It doesn't stop happening. It's not like the universe decides, right, nothing funny is going to happen right now.
Yeah.
And so when my father was dying, like, all kinds of ridiculous stuff was happening at any one time, and it's not that funny, but I mean, the night before my dad died, me and my brother were like so stressed because we'd been in the hospice for like 10 days with the family and all around the bedside, and I'd made the goodbye speech to my dad 4 times. And by the 4th time, he basically sat up and said, "I know you fucking love me! Just leave me alone! Please!" And you just get, life, it's not even like funny things happen, like life just continues. And it's very weird, and you go for a walk, or you're hungry, or something like that. I remember going, the night before my dad died, me and my brother were just, everyone was just stir crazy. We went out for a curry, and I had a very hot curry. And then there was a tiny ensuite toilet in the room where my dad was dying, and it's... It's just, this is literally the dictionary definition of too much information, but I had terrible diarrhea. And then I had to keep thinking, this is awful, but then somebody's got it worse very close to me. You know.
I think like that Catherine, might have been why he decided to go, I'm not hanging around with us.
Yes. I got really annoyed at the hospitalist nurse. I said, what about me? What about him? I've got really bad, my bottom really stings, you know? I want some palliative care as well. But no, it's all for him.
It's good. You've worked with all the big names in comedy. The incredible list. Mainly, Leon Herring is the,
yes.
The main...
I don't know anyone else that I will.
That's the main one you've worked with. Do you remember the tour... That we went on together.
I love you.
So we went. Sorry. We before like, and it was. It was maybe on the radio, but I don't think we were on the TV. Were we? Do you think when we did that tour? I think it was 90. I found a review. Yes. Someone sent me a review of it. I think it was 94. So it was before. It was like the radio. We'd done the radio shows. And you were doing Peter. This very brilliant character.
Oh, thank you.
That was probably the high. In fact, there was a review, someone sent me this review from the Leeds student newspaper. There was a bit, so you know, Lee and Herring, not sure, but the brilliant, hilarious Peter came on and did this, and then they were very rude about the open. We used to have an open spot on that tour. Do you remember that?
Oh, was it somebody that's now really famous?
No, it wasn't. It was like we'd go around different student unions, and then there would be an open spot from that student union. Oh. I'd completely forgotten about that.
Wow.
And then this review were lazy to this. Although, what did she say? She said, he said in the review, it says, I'm more handsome than my self-depreciating comments would suspect.
Right.
Which I quite like the idea of being self-depreciating. Yeah. It's better than self-deprecating. It's sort of true. I am self-depreciating.
It's like underconfident self-deprecating.
Yeah. There was a one performance of that I can't remember where it was, but it wasn't going very well. And do you remember running where you ran away?
Oh yes, God!
You actually ran off the stage and disappeared, and you were meant to come back at the end and didn't come back on at the end.
Yeah, that was very
What happened on that gig?
I think I just blanked and panicked. It probably will happen during this interview.
Yeah. I don't want to bring up anything.
Just like I get very scared. And
they were scary gigs. So we were not well known.
Yeah.
And we were travelling around to student unions, some of which I get confused because we did so many of these tours.
Yes.
And sometimes Kevin was with us and sometimes Richard Thomas was with us and sometimes you were with us. And, you know, sometimes you'd turn up at a place and there was the rugby club were in the bar and you were still expected to perform in a corner of the bar.
God, that's
so. Those were sort of tough ones.
No, I remember at the same around about the same time doing the Comedy Network tour. With Malcolm Hardy and Woody Bot Muddy, and just getting to places where it would just be a ropey Freshers Week, and there would be just a riot. And Malcolm Hardy would just say, "All right, knob out," and then would do his whole thing where he would just drop his trousers and show his gargantuan penis to the audience. And I think I need a new. I was going to say the new direction, but it's the whole. That rubbish old joke.
Anyway. It was happy times.
Yeah. Yes.
Happy times touring the country.
Yeah,
it was a weird thing.
Yeah.
But you in all seriousness, so you did radio stuff and TV stuff with Chris Morris.
Yeah.
And Armando Iannucci. And you've obviously been working with, and Alan Partridge. So you wrote the sitcom of I'm Alan Partridge. So you took over the day-to-day when me and Stu got kicked off it.
Right.
You took our place.
Yeah. Have you come to shame me for that? Yeah.
And then ended up writing I'm Alan Partridge and going to Hollywood. Nice to know
stealing your life.
It's nice to know where my career would have gone if we hadn't had that argument.
But I'm not happy.
No. No, but you wrote I'm Alan Partridge, which is one of the greatest sitcoms ever.
Oh, thank you.
It's really good. There's bits in it that there's a bit in I'm Alan Partridge where someone comes up to Alan Partridge and says, "Are you Alan Partridge?" And he goes, "Yes." And they go, "Oh, you dropped your credit card." That happened to me.
Yes,
that's my story. And there's a bit.
I want to apologise for that. I really do.
That's my story.
Because I do think I subconsciously stole that from your life, or consciously. Subconsciously is the cowardly way of saying.
Well, but what about the very famous scene where Alan Partridge goes back to the fan's house and there's all the posters mm-hmm. and. Yeah. Mannequins. Mm. That basically happened to Stuart. So
did
that's,
it?
Yeah. So Stuart right. went back to not exactly. He yeah. didn't run across the.
Oh my God, I
field.
Didn't know that one.
Did you not? No, I thought really? I assumed you must have known. He went, Stuart, and, well, we talked about this a lot on this podcast. Because mm. uh-huh. It's an amazing okay. story that keeps giving.
Yes.
In that it was this night that Stuart had mm. where he was locked out of his bed and breakfast, so a fan said, come back and stay. But a guy being his gig said, come back and stay at our flat. Mm. And then there were posters of Stu all over the wall in the house.
Right.
And all of the guy's flatmates were watching Animal Farm, the porn film. I don't think Jean Valjean's in that one. He would have probably been a bit young at the time. So it was kind of a weird experience. Mm-hmm. And then, but subsequently it turned out the student was, oh my God, I'm going to forget his name. Christian O'Connell. The DJ
oh my God,
Christian
the
O'Connell.
DJ. Who follows me on Twitter?
Does he?
Yes. I follow him back.
So I thought Christian O'Connell had been the inspiration for that guy.
So he was the man that had... He was the man fan. Wow.
Yeah. But he says that he had posters of all different comedians up there.
Right.
And he didn't have a tattoo, I don't think, of Stu on his...
Right.
I genuinely thought that had been an inspiration.
Honestly, I don't think so. I think it might have been already in the show when I came on because they worked up a couple of storylines already. Is my fame.
Well, all these things, but we worked together so closely in all that time. Mm-hmm. You know, then we were literally I was living with Stu, then I was living with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we were in each other's pockets stealing each other's bread.
Yes.
And
material and love.
So, you know, there was a lot of crossover.
Yeah.
Did Patrick Marber genuinely... there was a recent story that came out that Patrick Marber was furious when he first read the scripts of I'm Alan Partridge.
He didn't like it.
Yeah.
He came in and basically said, this is all... This, none of this works. And I remember us... We'd worked really hard on the first couple of episodes, and he came in to the rehearsal room, and I think they acted it. I think the cast actually acted right. out for him, and he basically said, "No, this is a disaster," and we were all very depressed and thought, "Fucking," because he said it in a very confident way.
Yeah,
and then the next morning we just came in and we went. We think he's wrong. We think that's shit. We think it's good. And so we then carried on, and then we made it. You know?
Yeah, we did, yeah. Mm. You did make it. I've seen us.
Yeah, we did.
Spoilers.
Yes.
Anyone who hasn't seen it yet. It was interesting, because Patrick was sort of like, didn't write that he was involved in the... Previous in the Know Me Knowing You, is that right?
So yeah. he was in it for a bit. They developed a few storylines
right.
for like about the first three episodes, I think, or three or four episodes, and so I came in and they had you know the bones of you know a few of those episodes, and then we you know
yeah
did a lot of improv and a lot of writing and rehearsing and you know.
But you performed it. So you do in the 90s. You were doing quite a lot of performance.
Mm-hmm.
You were in Friday Night, Saturday Night Armistice,
mm-hmm.
the arch satirical show. And you were, you know, you're doing, there's a bit where you're in mm-hmm. I'm Alan Partridge, doing mm-hmm. the voice thing in your throat.
Yes, yeah, that was my
thing. Couldn't do that now, could you? Mm-hmm. Political correctness gone mad. Mm-hmm. And so you still do little bits and pieces in things you've written, but do you miss the performing, or are you glad that you've gone to writing?
Not really, I get scared. And before my dad died, the last thing I did before my dad passed away...
The last thing he said to you was, don't do that pot noodle episode.
That was his... The funny thing was that the pot noodle... I think that was his proudest. Because his friends down the pub could go, I saw your son on the telly.
It's good. They're funny.
Gorgeous. Funny, isn't it?
They're funny. They are funny. I watched. They're all on YouTube. You can go and look at them all. They're all good.
Gangs of Welsh men would corner me in the streets in Cardiff, and they would say, "You're the bloke from the ad." And I say, "Yeah. Say the catchphrase." Too gorgeous. In the voice. This is really frightening, men. I go, too gorgeous, and then they just buy me a drink. But
yeah.
But my dad. No, the last thing I did before my dad passed away was I played a pimp in The Bill.
Right.
As he was like slipping away. You never knew. Well, you know. But no, I don't. Yeah, I'm quite scared of it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get scared when I go to my daughter's school, and like my daughter's school in LA, that you, for their birthday, you read a book to them. And when I'm reading, you know, just read a chapter of a book, and I just think, even like some kids in kindergarten, I just think they're going to shout, "Get off your shit!" You know.
I think that going through that kind of baptism of fire of doing stand up in the early 90s, which we both did, and I had a horrible time doing stand up on my own.
Yeah.
And we had a horrible time doing Lee and Herring some of the time, and mostly it was better with Lee and Herring. But it's, you know, that's a very hard thing to shake off. And you've got, I suppose you do need to, there's a certain, to carry on being a performer, I think there is a certain level of, I need, you know, I can get through this, and I will get through this, and I'll get through to the bit where it doesn't harm me anymore.
So yeah, I've got huge, such admiration for what you do, because I, like, you know, I listen to your podcast and I listen to Mark Maron, and it's like I hear people, and you know, I heard you saying, you know, earlier, like when you know, you don't want to do anything else.
Yeah.
And I'm not, you know, I don't want to do anything else but write.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just so, because I just, my skin would, like, I would turn up at gigs, and presumably you don't get this because you like doing it. Or do you? Do you get?
I mean, I don't get nervous.
I would get, so, on a Saturday, years after I stopped doing it, I would just have that feeling on a Saturday when I typically have a gig of like, and then I think, I don't have to do anything. I'd be so happy. And I think, all right, that was an indication that it wasn't the life for me.
I mean, I think I really like writing as well. You know, I haven't had anywhere near the same kind of level of success of you at that. But I think if I don't perform, and it doesn't have to be a big deal. When I came back to doing stand-up in like 2004, I just sort of realised, even if I just went and did a little gig above a pub to six people, that was enough.
Right.
I remember passing the Hammersmith Apollo, and Jimmy Carr was on, and I went round the corner to a pub, and literally six people in the audience.
Wow.
And I was thinking, I genuinely am just as happy as doing this. I've also played the Hammersmith Apollo like for 5 minutes, and it's amazing. So I'm not saying I wouldn't do it if I got the chance, but as long as I got that, you know, scratch that itch, I then don't mind spending a couple of months at home writing. But I find writing, do you find this, but you write quite collaboratively with people, don't you?
Yeah.
So I just find, and I don't anymore, I just find it quite lonely, and that drives me mad. That sort of sitting down process of really
I like both. I mean, I'm quite weirdly self-contained and just like a strange hermit man, that I like being at home on my own, looking at porn with men.
look
a little bit like buff versions of me. Of course I know him. I've got every one of that guy's films.
He's welcome to come on the podcast.
I'm doing a new pot noodle ad so that I can earn money to have plastic surgery to look like that man.
He's got a very cheeky little look to him. He's got a little cheeky look. He's very good. Many of the actors in those films aren't. Yes. You know, I have to say the acting is poor.
Yes.
The actual acting bits, and I like the acting bits.
Right.
More, if I'm honest, than the sex bits.
So you watch?
I should just watch regular dramas.
Right. Do you watch the old-fashioned ones with the storyline? With the story,
like,
you watch them.
I want the ones with the story, and then when the story stops, I get bored. Yes. I like the story. Then they start having sex with people in their anuses. Oh, come on! Yeah. No need for that. you don't need to show it. And just allude. He could go, "I'm about to fuck you, Ness." Crossfade. Oh, it was good when you crap fucked me in the ass. Yes, it was. Too gorgeous. I do understand that, and I think again, as you know, it's a nice thing to be able to work it in your home and be with your family. And your home is now in Hollywood.
Well,
let's
go Hancock. I mean, it's close to Hollywood. Yeah,
okay.
It's like, you know,
but it's
like quite hideous. It's like, I mean, there is obviously glamorous bits there, but like when I first drove down Sunset Boulevard, it's a shit. It's like a posh shanty town. It's kind of weird. It's not. I mean, I'd like it there because I like the hills and it's sunny and all that. But it's kind of, you know, it's not pretty, and it's like, it's funny how it's got that because the movies get made there, but it's kind of. kind of a dump, a lot of it.
But you got nominated for an Oscar. Mm. So did you go? You must have gone to the Oscars that year. For yes. Borat.
Yes.
How much of Borat was written, though? Because it was felt like a very improvised film.
Well, it was a lot of it was written. Because it was like, a lot of it was like, the storyline was completely, we worked on that for about 6 months. Because the original plan when I went out there was that he'd been trying to do it a different way, but he had a director who then left the movie who said, right, we're just going to show up at different places and, you know, you're going to just fuck about with people and then we're going to make a movie out of it. And that wasn't working. So when I came in, we sat down and worked out a storyline. We basically stole the plots of 8 road movies and, you know, and just watched like Planes, Trains and Automobiles and things like that. And we then worked out a structure and then it became things like, well, we had a wall of things. Basically, it was just excuses to go to a mega church, excuses to have a naked fight, or excuses for whatever, to have a driving lesson. So we would do things like, well, we want him to go to a mega church and fuck about with Christians. So where's, and all right, we'll take the low point of the movie when he's down on his luck, and that's the good place to get Jesus. And so it was a lot of that, trying to figure out, oh, we wanted him to meet some racist frat boys.
Yeah.
So we think, well, when's a good time? So then, all right, he's lost his dream of meeting Pamela Anderson, which he believes will happen.
Yeah.
So he can meet some frat boys, and then we would structure it so that he would say to them things that then would move the story along.
Okay. Yeah.
So he would say things like, "I'm going to meet my wife in." I'm not going to try the accent, but I'm going to meet my wife in Los Angeles. I am trying the accent.
You are trying it. It's good. You could have done that. You could have been more.
It's just like, you know, Bob Dylan. Same impression. he would say, like, say to some frat boys,
"Yeah,
I'm going to meet my girl," and then he'd show them a picture, and then they say, "She's not. You're not going to marry her." And so, and then each day he would go filming. We'd have like a ton of material that was prepared, but then he would then obviously improvise around it brilliantly.
You know? And how did you feel at when you were at the Oscars? Did that, you know,
it was strange.
Yeah.
Very strange.
Because usually I say to people, you know, like lots of people who are in Hollywood films and that I interview on this are all like, it's all normal being in hanging out with celebrities.
But I just ridiculed by everyone. I was ridiculed by everyone I knew because I turned up with my girlfriend and my wife. We turned up so early and did the line, you know, the interview technically, if you're nominated, they have to let you go along that line.
Right.
But nobody, like a writer on that, which a movie that wasn't going to win, would do that. Because why would Ryan Seacrest, bad example, but why would one of those people want to interview you, but they technically, so you go along the line, and it was ridiculous. But I went a bit, if I had my time again with that, I would just obviously accept the fact that you're not going to win, because you know, a Martin Scorsese film is also in the running, so it's nice to get nominated. Yeah. People said to me, like, just enjoy it. You're fucking nominated for Oscar.
Yeah.
But I panicked and thought we might win, so then became slightly obsessed with the idea of winning. And what can we do to win?
Yeah.
And I nearly hired a PR person, but didn't, because that would be so stupid. Because we weren't going to win. But it was nuts. I took my mum to the Oscars luncheon. And she met Clint Eastwood.
Okay.
And actually my mum, and I've got a picture at home with my mum with Clint Eastwood. And she passed away a couple of years ago. And but one day when she was back...
I'm delighted, Pete.
Sorry. but I got this picture of my mum that she had in her flat in Cardiff, in her sheltered accommodation flat in Cardiff. And one day a carer came in and saw a picture of my mum with Clint Eastwood and said, "Oh, that's lovely, Doe. Did you go to Madame Tussauds?" and my mum said, "No, that's I met Clint Eastwood in LA. And the carer went, "Oh. Yes, of course you did. Yes. That was good. That was the best thing. I wish I could have enjoyed it more. It was stupid.
It's so ridiculous. I mean, I think anyone, especially like if you, and I don't picture like this, but anyone who knew you as Peter from this film, the idea of you living in Hollywood with an Oscar nomination, and, you know, it's so, or the Two Gorgeous Men, it's so wonderful, you know, it's wonderful and utterly deserved. And then you wrote Arthur as well, so that spoiled it.
Can I tell you something about Arthur?
Yeah, please do.
A few months ago, I found online, I don't know why I was searching for Peter Bainham Arthur. Online, why would you do that? Peter Bainham porn movies, maybe. And I stumbled on a picture that looked like it was in the style of the cartoonist Joseph Champness, who used to do stuff for you, didn't he? I don't know if he still does.
But no, he did some stuff for this
morning.
But
it looked very much in his style.
Yeah.
And it was a cartoon of me and Russell Brand pissing on the grave of Dudley Moore.
Well, I, you know,
which I thought was deserved. No,
well, I don't know. I think, like, it's a weird choice to remake anything in some ways.
Yes.
But, Arthur wasn't all... The original Arthur wasn't that great a film.
It was nice. It was very charming. Right. But it's just Dudley Moore, like, he was so... Yeah. Brilliant.
I mean, he's loved and he was good in it. Yes. But it wasn't like his best. The best stuff's when he's swearing with Peter Cook. that's what he should have carried on doing. He shouldn't have gone off to Hollywood and do those films. You know, you don't know. Well, we had Russell on and we talked, and I took the piss out of Arthur, obviously. Mm. And off. Because that's what I do. That's what I'm here for.
I like to think I helped him go in a new direction in his career. Because he's doing really good stuff now. And I know that was particularly what he should have been doing anyway. You know, I think he would probably say that, would he?
Yeah,
I'm panicking now.
I think possible. I mean, it's a weird, but that's a weird story. You know, you get swept along with something, and you don't get, as a writer and a performer, you get a certain amount of choice about what you're doing, but also things come up and you make it go, well, let's give this a go. You don't know how it's going to turn out.
No,
that's what he was saying about it. You know, he said, you know, this could have turned out great. Helen Mirren was in it. Peter Bainham's writing for it.
Yeah.
And he's Russell's a massive fan of all the stuff we used to do.
Right.
So he would have been very excited about having you in writing for it.
Well, it was weird. Like, I got the call, you know, my agent called me. Sort of Ronnie Goldman, the heavens opened. And, my agent, such a dick, didn't it? And said, do you want to do a remake of Arthur with Russell Brand? And I went, no. I did. And I liked him, but I thought, no, because the original's got some really nice moments. Yeah, it's charming. It's not a brilliant movie, but it's charming. And it's got lots of funny, semi-iconic bits in it.
Sure.
And I thought, no, that's ridiculous. Why would you do that? And then I went along and they said, well, you just have the meeting. And I went and met him, and he was lovely. And he is, and he's very charming. Yeah. And he says your name a lot, which I just fall for instantly. If somebody says my name, you know, when you used to say Pete, you stole my bread, Pete. Do you think it's funny that my granddad's died, Pete? I will just, I'm like a cat with some milk, you know. And so I just, and then funny enough, and then when it came out and bombed, it's funny how you then, when you make odd decisions, you then go back to that original instinct and go, why, no, I should have just followed that. You know, it's a good lesson in following your initial cut instinct.
Sure, but then sometimes those things turn out to be like amazing.
They do,
there's no, you know, there's no way of knowing.
Actually, before I went out to do Borat, when I got the call for that, I remember like quite a lot of people here saying to me, I don't know, like it's a funny thing in the Ali G show, it's kind of but a movie? I mean, people said that to me.
Yeah.
Nah, and they just, and I turned it down.
Right.
He called me and said, and I rang him back and left a message and said, you know, and I was writing a bad sitcom about myself, and I turned him down, and then I went to the pub with my friend Jez and said, yeah, I'm not going to do that Borat thing. And he said, are you fucking mad? And I instantly went, oh my God, you're right. And I rang him up like,
please let me do it. I'm sorry. I won't.
I'm very sorry. And I said, like, and I rang him up and I said, like, I'm sorry, I've got no dignity, but I want to reverse my position completely. Because I give one of those wanky answers where I'm really going to follow what I've got responsibilities. And then I said, I'm sorry, that was whole shit what I said on the phone yesterday. And I got no dignity, and to his credit, he said, I've got no dignity either. And obviously, he didn't, you know. You've seen the movie, you know, like
balls, but it's incredible
naked
that these
fights and balls in his face.
That's true.
You know,
yes. It's incredible that, I mean, and again, it's not incredible, but it's all these people want to work with you, and you're sort of behind all these, you know, you, and I'm Alan Partridge. I can sort of see the bits. Mm. Obviously, I got that one wrong, but I can usually see the bits that are Peter Bainham, you know, that you've written, because I know you so well. But you know, you're working with all these, you know, those are all the most important people of, you know, the last 20 or 30 years are asking for you to write for
That's
them.
That's nice.
Yeah. And there was a documentary about you, wasn't there, on the Welsh radio?
Oh, my God.
You're the greatest writer to ever come out of Wales.
I forgot about the internet. I forgot about BBC iPlayer where that can come out of Wales. Did you hear it? I haven't heard it.
Okay, yes.
Because
we weren't asked to be on it, so I thought...
Oh.
They didn't ask us to comment.
Oh, I gave them your names.
I'd have just said... He doesn't put the bread back in the fridge. I'm going to ask you some... this is the most question I've written especially for you. Is sex with a Frankenstein cheating? If you're in a relationship with someone, but you have sex with a Frankenstein...
Yes.
Is that cheating?
No. No, it feels like it's a very strange form of masturbating. Because... I know, is a Frankenstein conscious?
Yes. So Frankenstein is made out of the...
Right.
Several corpses stitched together.
Right.
And then reanimated. And that's the whole point, you know. Does he have rights and a soul? And
Like a robot.
Well, no, a robot's different. I haven't asked you the robot question. This is a new question.
Right.
Because Frankenstein... It should be Frankenstein's monster. I know I'm getting it wrong.
Yes.
He's a loving thing. What if part of the Frankenstein is made of part of your partner?
Their body part has been removed.
Yeah, well, your partner sadly died, and I'm delighted.
Yes.
But Dr. Frankenstein comes in and goes...
Yes.
I've built a Frankenstein. I couldn't use most of your partner, but there's a bit of her in there. That's her arm.
Am I allowed to know what part?
I think you'd recognise, wouldn't you? I know that arm.
Most of it, yeah.
Penis, I don't think was there.
Yeah.
Jean Valjean's massive penis.
Yeah.
So would it then, if that's the only way to... Yes. I'm just putting forward some possibilities.
Yes.
Because the marriage vows are very strict on stuff like this. So I'm just.
Yes. Are they specific about this?
But they are.
What marriage vows are specific about having
there's
sex?
There's gaps in the marriage vows.
Reanimated partial corpse of your partner.
They don't mention this. That's what I'm saying. You've got to find the loopholes.
Right.
And so I would say having sex with Frankenstein is cheating.
Yes.
Because it's a different person and it's alive, it's not a robot or a puppet.
Right.
But say my wife would sadly die, and then there was a Frankenstein. It had a bit of a face,
right? Yeah,
and maybe a bum.
Right. Are you talking about a male Frankenstein with your partner's, your female partner's face?
Well, you don't necessarily get the choice of what sex is going to be,
okay?
Because it's just whatever bits are lying around, isn't it? And they're fresh enough to reuse.
Assuming in all of this that you are capable of this, that you somehow in this scenario can get aroused by this horrifying thing?
It might. Some Frankensteins are better looking than other ones.
All right, yes.
What if...
Oh.
You had sex with someone who's had... an organ transplant from your partner, so maybe they've been given one of your partner's kidneys.
Right. Yeah.
So it's a different person, but there's a bit of your partner.
And they're alive.
They're all alive, and your partner's still alive.
Right.
Oh. Is it cheating? Well, because they've just donated a kidney, maybe.
Right.
Or they're dead and it's their heart. Is that cheating?
That's cheating.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, I'm just getting your moral compass.
Yeah, I think that's cheating. That's wrong, that one.
I thought I was very proud of that last night when I was thinking of sleeping, unable to sleep, thinking of all the different parts of that emergency question. I thought that's a good one.
Right.
Have you ever improvised a condom?
No. I don't know what to
Have
say.
You ever reused the condom that you'd used once and there wasn't one around, so you put the same one back on again?
No.
Have you ever had sex twice with the same person in a row?
Twice with the same person? Is that a trick question? I'm trying to think. Wait a minute. Well, I've had sex with my wife more than one time.
You've got two children.
Does that count?
Yeah. Okay, we'll go back. I thought the Frankenstein was a winner.
Yeah.
Have you ever met Adam Sandler in real life?
I have.
Yeah, have you worked with him?
I have. I wrote the cartoon Hotel Transylvania.
Oh, he's in that, isn't he? Yeah.
Yes. And I had a meeting with him. I went to his Hawaiian-themed office on the lot at Sony Pictures.
Oh, yeah.
And met him one time and
is he a nice guy?
He was nice. Yeah. Yes. And then I went away and I never saw him again. And then they made the movie.
Yeah.
And used the Frankenstein of my they used the organs of my script to, you know. Yes. And then somebody else. But yeah.
Yeah. Hmm? He's good. He's good, isn't he? Adam Sandler.
He's in that Meyerowitz story.
Yeah, that's meant to be very good. I can watch it.
So I keep watching bits of.
Yeah, I watched a bit of it, and then there wasn't enough of him putting on the shoes of people and turning into them in it for me.
Yeah. Were you waiting for that to happen? Yeah. We're even 3 minutes before the end of the movie going, there's still time.
When's he going to come on playing his own sister? That's what I was waiting for, wearing her shoe.
Okay.
That's there. Don't worry. That's the people. There's some requests from the audience.
Okay,
we'll come back to that. I've looked at your YouGov. You know, there's a YouGov profile of what your ultimate fan is.
Am I what?
There's YouGov do these profiles of everyone.
Yes,
and you can find out what your fan is, what your main fan. What's unique about your fans?
Seriously?
Yeah, and they're everyone. Including you, your fans primarily work in mining and quarry. That's their main occupation. Right. And their favourite
quarries,
quarries and mining. Their favourite TV show is Andrew Marr's History of the World, which I think's funnier than the mining.
Yes.
There's a lot of miners. Yes. Going, do you like Peter Bain and me up? Do you like, what's your favourite show? Andrew Marr's History of the World. I've done YouGov for a while.
Is that actually a real?
Yeah, that's a real website. You can look up YouGov.com and put your name in, or anyone's name, and you can find out what their fans like.
Is it? I think it's
based on an algorithm where it tells you, it's not actually what's the most popular answer, it's what's the most unique to you answer. So what happens is they've asked 10 people and two of them work in quarrying and mining and nobody else's fans work in quarrying and mining.
Right.
I would say, but that's
so strange.
What is Chris Morris like in real life?
He's nice.
Yeah, that's what I've thought. Do you remember when you used to do, my favourite thing we used to do on the radio show, which was yours, was Mad Thoughts. Do you remember the Mad Thoughts?
Yes.
Do you, imagine, do you have any favourite mad thoughts? Can you give an example of mad thoughts?
My favourite's difficult, isn't it? Because it's like ringing, leaving a message about serial killers killing. You know, it's like favourite implies you want to do those things.
And, yeah.
You know, my most common one would be being on the train and sitting opposite some sweet old man, and I'd have a cup of hot tea and just imagining what if I just threw the hot tea in the old man's face. Yeah. And then he would be screaming in pain. And then I would go... So in an instant, you'd have an entire, very, very detailed scenario of the aftermath of the hot tea in the old man's face. And, you know, then it's just quite often in a meeting in LA, I'll just think of something awful, awful to say to the person I'm in the meeting with. And then that would be... And then I'd have to go home and say to my wife, I said this thing in the meeting... And I just said, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. So like it's, you know, and, or...
That was basically my meeting with Channel 4, to be honest. It's probably why I'm not doing so well with the script writing. There was the idea...
Pushing
of those
people on cheap platforms.
Yeah, but do you... Well, but do you worry...
That's a big one, yeah.
As you get... I mean, this is... I realised once you got kids, you have them all the time, like horrible things where
imagining what you, the worst thing that could happen to your kids and your culpability in some of those things. So it's an awful, awful thing. But, you know, do you worry in, I did a routine about it, and then the worry that, you know, some, you might go mad and actually do those things.
I mean, my, you know, when my, she's now 10, my 10-year-old was born, I remember we got her home from the hospital and she was looking so adorable and lovely and innocent. And I remember saying to my wife, imagine if we left her in a forest. And she cried.
Yeah, mums don't like it as much. Mums don't like these.
No, she's just had a baby. There's hormonal activity. Yeah. There's a very powerful, instinctive mother bear urge. And then she's got the image in her head of that baby being alone in a forest.
Yeah.
And she cried. It was a pattern. Just I'm a horrible person, obviously, to say these things. But then I do imagine, I have that side of it, which I got from my dad, actually, of just if I don't hear from my wife for, like, you know, I call her and I don't hear back from her, I then am tortured by the mad thought of she's obviously been murdered. And, you know, obviously. My dad used to do that. He used to just say, I'd come home from the pub when I would go home to Cardiff and he would say, imagine you in a ditch and the tar had crashed and the steering column was going right through your stomach.
But it is, but it makes life sort of unbearable because you can't really enjoy anything for the fear of...
Yes.
It comes out... Well, I think it's there's meant to be a reason, you know, a reason for this, like, through evolution, that if you worry about those things... Well, yeah, that you'll stop... Because it's so... You make yourself think of the worst possible thing, so you don't do it because it's so horrible. But then it's also... There's something that makes... There's some... impulse in you for some reason that may, and some of them just aren't helpful.
Yes,
there's some of them aren't like this is this will help you in your life. It's like, this is awful, you're making me think terrible things that aren't possibly, like, when my daughter was born and I was having all these mad thoughts, there was a voice of heads generally saying, what, you know, some people generally do go crazy though and do these awful things to their kids, what if you're one of those people?
If I do that,
and you go, but how does that help me to suggest that I should disobey the voice?
Well, that's the thing, specifically.
Obey the voice. And
well, it's very much not... The horrible thing about mad thoughts is aren't even what if I did this, it's what if I do this.
Yeah.
What if I actually do drive her to a forest and just gently set the... Sorry. My wife cannot now hear this show. Horrible.
We'll send you a version with this bit in.
Okay.
You can play to her. But it's true, surprisingly, my wife is similar when I talk about what if I trip and my son ends up in the wood burner. or what if I just place him in there? It would be really bad. I won't do it because it would be so bad.
Yes. I had somebody tell me, like, before I had kids, like, I think around about the time we would do those mad thoughts.
Yeah.
And he said, wait till you have kids. You won't say that stuff then.
Yeah.
Absolute bollocks.
Yeah.
It doesn't go away. Just like the horrible stuff. Yeah. That's the thing about dark humor. It's not like you sit there trying to think of awful things.
No.
It's just certain warped people, this stuff enters your head.
But it's like, you know? I did a similar joke about that, because, like, people say, when you've got kids, you won't do jokes about paedophiles or paedophilia. Because, you know, you won't be able to stand it. You won't. And now I've got kids, I've realised they were right, because now I've got kids, I've realised paedophilia is really bad, isn't it? I didn't realise before. Yeah. Before I just thought it was a bit of fun. You know, it's like the idea that when you were doing those jokes, that you were somehow serious, that you were like, they said, you know, it would be bad if you let your child in the forest. Oh, God, sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course. Well,
now I say that. What did you think the joke was? The joke is the thing I'm saying is the worst possible thing.
The thing that scares me the most is the whole, and I do it a lot, is like the terror, which the most scary thing is, but this is something I'm very capable of, is leaving my child somewhere. Just putting it, especially in LA where you drive all over the place. The other day I was somewhere with my daughter, Neris, and I had to look around, oh my God, because I forgot, even though I was holding her hand, I was spacing out. And on the tube going somewhere with her, and I just thought, like, what if I've left her?
You have to concentrate, Pete. It's one of the main things about being a parent.
About parenting.
I'm just fearing this bit of this podcast is one day going to be used in a court case. Where he did say he often just forgot he had kids.
Yes.
left him on the tube and in a forest.
Do you think it'd be wrong to have actually surgically your child surgically grafted to you so that you can never leave them?
No, I don't think that'd be wrong. I think it'd be good. So I will ask you, oh my goodness, time flies by, doesn't it? It's been lots of fun talking to you, and there's so much more that I could talk to you about. I will ask you this question, as it's been requested from the audience. If you had to be in a human centipede with two other people, if you had to be, and you're aware of the human centipede phenomenon, I'm sorry we've lowered the tone. You're in the middle, but you get to choose who's at the other, whose anus your mouth is stitched to, and whose mouth is stitched to your anus.
Right.
Which two people would you choose, and who would be in front of you, and who would be behind?
Donald Trump and Mike Pence. Because I would sacrifice myself for the horror they would have to go through. I would be. No, that's not true, is it?
Well, none of it's true. But yes. I feel slightly worried for my expat friends out in America now, who are writing satirical comedy. John Oliver and you are writing, and you often tweet Donald Trump and tell him what a prick you think he is, basically. It's concerning the way the world's going.
Yes.
But do you ever worry that, you know, he might gain so much power that he can sort of take his vengeance on, as he would like to, on these people who mock him? Because he hates being mocked.
Yes.
And
he's got that instinct, hasn't he? It's like when I became a citizen of the United States, which is a horrifying... No, no, but I did it before him. I didn't do it because Donald Trump became... I know how I'm going to celebrate the election of Donald Trump. I'm going to become a citizen. But I remember having to learn about the Constitution, and it's so incredibly boringly detailed in its kind of way that it's designed to stop dictators.
Yeah.
Except, obviously, Donald Trump gets in. And the terrifying thing is he's got an instinct to autocracy. And it's very hard, isn't it? Because he makes probably a joke, but when he said the other day about the Chinese president becoming like a president for life, and hey, we should maybe try that. But it's that kind of thing when people make jokes about stuff where you go, but you're just joking about that because you love that idea, you know? And I don't know. The whole thing's frightening. I think it could happen because I think what he's waiting for, to be honest, is a huge terrorist. You know, when he gets some, the theory is he'll make some sort of power grab and shut down the press if there's a war. If he goes to war with North Korea, he can shut down the press and then he can, you know, take
over. Yeah, do you think? I mean, it's almost inconceivable, but then everything's happened so far, it's been quite inconceivable.
Well, that's it. Nobody thought any of it would happen, so now it's all like, I'm pretty sure he'll win the next election because. What a horrible thing to say, but that's almost like some weird mad thoughts insulation against it happening. You know, you think like, it seems very possible. And
but the thing is, like that, you know, it's sort of so easy in America, as we're seeing, to kill lots of people.
Yes,
and yet no terrorists are managing. The Americans are doing a lot better at it than the terrorists.
Yes,
on the whole.
Oh yeah, well it's all those.
And
like,
so that, it just would make you think this is crazy. This is. Yeah. You know, it's crazy to be scared of terrorism when the danger is much closer to home than terrorists.
I know, but there's no... Obviously, that's the frightening thing about it. That's what it feels like, elements of it feel like when countries swing to the right, because they've got somebody in power who feeds on that. It's like, and obviously, the cliche and the truth is that here as well, that people are more afraid of foreigners, more afraid of the less they know. So if you live in a city, if you live in a major city where there's like, it's a big mix of all kinds of cultures, there's no, you know, people aren't living in constant fear, but you go out to like Iowa or Idaho and you go to Alabama and you go into a place where just everyone's right. They're absolutely terrified there that they're going to get blown up. You know, they're just living, and whereas like people go around big cities not living with that fear.
Yeah.
And so there's just nothing rational about it, you know. And but I live in the ridiculous elite bubble of California where it's
for now
until
they come and take you away at night.
Yeah, is that what they do?
Put you in a gulag.
Okay,
he likes the Russians, so you know there's every chance. Every chance that might happen. I if it does happen, Pete.
Yeah,
I won't even be delighted. I'll be upset if you are if you are murdered by Donald Trump. I'll be pretty peeved about that.
Yeah.
And that's I will tell him. Then I'll send him a copy of this podcast and I go, actually, yeah, I'm glad that guy, that is, it's good, yeah, that guy's
horrible
off the
things he said about leaving his daughter in a forest.
So look, we're gonna have to stop because you know, these people have to get home. I live in Hertfordshire now. I have to get a train. It's ridiculous. But it's been so lovely to see you, and you're over doing some stuff in the UK, writing some more.
Animated.
You've been writing animated
cartoon.
Kids films, yeah.
An
animated cartoon.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That a
I'm
new
doing
thing?
Any of those live action cartoons? Yeah. You know.
So we'll see. We'll hear lots more from you, and it's fantastic to talk to you, ladies and gentlemen. It's Peter Bainer. Too gorgeous. Too gorgeous. Podcast with me, Rich Hang, and my guest, Peter Tugardias Bainham. The music is by Pess. The people I have to thank are everyone at the British Comedy Guide, everyone at the Square Theatre, everyone at Go Faster Stripes, especially Chris Evans, not that one. My producer, of course, I'm indebted to, is Ben Walker. And this is a Sky Potato, because it's the worst titles I've ever done. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripes.com production. Goodbye!
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And GoFasterStripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who said hello so far. I do come and say hello after the show. If you enjoyed it, if you want to see me, that'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.